barely enough energy to sip his three martinis and watch TV. And the worst of it was that he never read. How fluently, how confidently he had once conversed about literature. How much his love of Middlemarch and Daniel Deronda had endeared him to her. And what a shock to realize only a short time later that she had mistaken form for substance. Not only were Earl's literary observations memorized, but his repertory of books was limited and static. That was the toughest hit. How could she have ever loved a man who did not read? She, whose dearest and closest friends dwelled in the pages of George Eliot, Wolfe, Murdoch, Gaskell, and Byatt. And that was where John, a red-haired associate professor in her department at Berkeley with an armful of books, a long, graceful neck, and a stand-up Adam's apple, came in. Though English professors were expected to be well-read, she had known too many who rarely ventured outside of their century of expertise and were complete strangers to new fiction. But John read everything. 3 years before she had supported his tenure appointment on the basis of his two dazzling books, Chess, The Aesthetics of Brutality in Contemporary Fiction, and No Sir, The Androgynous Heroine in Late 19th Century British Literature. Their friendship germinated in all the familiar romantic academic haunts. Faculty and departmental committee meetings, faculty club luncheons, monthly readings in the Norris Auditorium by the poet or novelist in residence. It took root and blossomed in shared academic adventures, such as team teaching the 19th century greats in the Western Civilization curriculum, or guest lectures in each other's courses. And then permanent bonding took place in the trench warfare of faculty senate squabbles, space and salary sorties, and brutal promotion committee melees. Before long, they so trusted each other's taste that they rarely looked elsewhere for recommendations for novels and poetry. And the email ether between them crackled with meaty philosophical literary passages. Both eschewed quotations that were merely decorative or clumsily clever. They settled for nothing less than the sublime. Beauty plus wisdom for the ages. They both loathed Fitzgerald and Hemingway. Both loved Dickinson and Emerson. As their shared stack of books grew taller, their relationship evolved into ever greater harmony. They were moved by the same profound thoughts of the same writers. They reached epiphanies together. In short, these two English professors were in love. "You leave your marriage, and I'll leave mine." Who said it first? Neither could remember, but at some point in their second year of team teaching, they arrived at this high-risk amorous commitment. Pam was ready, but John, who had two preteen daughters, naturally required more time. Pam was patient. Her man, John, was, thank God, a good man, and required time to wrestle with such moral issues as the meaning of the marriage vow. And he struggled, too, with the problem of guilt at abandoning his children, and how one goes about leaving a wife whose only offense had been dullness. A wife transformed by duty from sparkling lover into drab motherhood. Over and over again, John assured Pam that he was en route, in process. That he had successfully identified and reconnoitered the problem. And all he needed now was more time to generate the resolve and select the propitious moment to act. But the months passed, and the propitious moment never arrived. Pam suspected that John, like so many dissatisfied spouses attempting to avoid the guilt and the burden of irreversible immoral acts, was trying to maneuver his wife into making the decision. He withdrew, lost all sexual interest in his wife, and criticized her silently and occasionally out loud. It was the old, I can't leave, but I pray that she leaves, maneuver. But it wasn't working. This wife wouldn't bite. Finally, Pam acted unilaterally. Her course of action was prompted by two phone calls beginning with, "Dearie, I think you'd like to know." Two of Earl's patients, under the pretense of doing her a favor, warned her of his sexually predatory behavior. When a summons arrived with the news that Earl was being sued for unprofessional behavior by yet another patient, Pam thanked her lucky stars she had not had a child and reached for the phone to contact a divorce lawyer. Might her act force John into decisive action? Even though she would have left her marriage if there had been no John in her life, Pam, in an astounding feat of denial, persuaded herself that she had left Earl for the sake of her lover and continued to confront John with that version of reality. But John dallied. He was still not ready. Then, one day, he took decisive action. It happened in June on the last day of classes, just after an ecstatic love fest in their usual bower. An unrolled blue foam mattress situated partially under the tent of his desk on the hardwood floor of his office. No sofas were to be found in English professors' offices. The department had been so racked by charges of professors preying on their female students that sofas had been banned. After zipping up his trousers, John gazed at her mournfully. "Pam, I love you. And because I love you, I've decided to be resolute. This is unfair to you, and I've got to take some of the pressure off of you, especially, but off me as well. I've decided to declare a moratorium on our seeing one another." Pam was stunned. She hardly heard his words. For days afterward, his message felt like a bolus in her gut, too large to digest, too heavy to regurgitate. Hour upon hour, she oscillated between hating him, loving him and desiring him, and wishing him dead. Her mind played one scenario after another. John and his family dying in an auto accident. John's wife being killed in an airplane crash, and John appearing, sometimes with children, sometimes alone, at her doorstep. Sometimes she would fall into his arms. Sometimes they would weep tenderly together. Sometimes she would pretend there was a man in her apartment and slam the door in his face. During the 2 years she had been in individual and group therapy, Pam had profited enormously, but in this crisis, therapy failed to deliver. It was no match for the monstrous power of her obsessional thinking. Julius tried valiantly. He was indefatigable and pulled endless devices out of his toolkit. First, he asked her to monitor herself and chart the amount of time she spent on the obsession. 200 to 300 minutes a day. Astounding. And it seemed entirely out of her control. The obsession had demonic power. Julius attempted to help her regain control of her mind by urging a systematic incremental decrease of her fantasy time. When that failed, he turned to a paradoxical approach and instructed her to choose an hour each morning which she would entirely devote to running the most popular fantasy reels about John. Though she followed Julius's instructions, the unruly obsession refused containment and spilled over into her thoughts just as much as before. Later, he suggested several thought-stopping techniques. For days, Pam shouted no at her own mind, or snapped rubber bands on her wrist. Julius also attempted to diffuse the obsession by laying bare its underlying meaning. The obsession is a distraction. It protects you from thinking about something else, he insisted. What is it concealing? If there were no obsession, what would you be thinking about? But the obsession would not yield. The group members pitched in. They shared their own obsessive episodes. They volunteered for phone duty so Pam could call them anytime she felt overcome. They urged her to fill her life, call her friends, arrange a social activity every day, find a man, and for God's sake, get laid. Tony made her smile by requesting an application for that position. But nothing worked. Against the monstrous power of the obsession, all of these therapy weapons were as effective as a BB gun against a charging rhinoceros. Then came a chance encounter with Marjorie, the starry-eyed graduate student cum Vipassana acolyte, who consulted her about a change in her dissertation topic. She had lost interest in the influence of Plato's concepts of love in the works of Juno Barnes. Instead, she had developed a crush on Larry, Somerset Maugham's protagonist in The Razor's Edge, and now proposed the topic of Origins of Eastern Religious Thought in Maugham and Hesse. In their conversations, Pam was struck by one of Marjorie's and Maugham's pet phrases, the calming of the mind. The phrase seemed so enticing, so seductive. The more she thought about it, the more she realized that mind-calming was exactly what she needed. And since neither individual nor group therapy seemed capable of offering it, Pam decided to heed Marjorie's advice. So she booked airline passage to India and to Goenka, the epicenter of mind-calming. The routine at the ashram had indeed begun to offer some mind-calming. Her mind fixated less on John, but now Pam was beginning to feel that the insomnia was worse than the obsession. She lay awake listening to the sounds of the night, a background beat of rhythmic breathing and the libretto of snores, moans, and snorts. About every 15 minutes, she was jolted by the shrill sound of a police whistle outside her window. But why could she not sink into sleep? It had to be related to the 12 hours of meditation every day. What else could it be? Yet the 150 other students seemed to be resting comfortably in the arms of Morpheus. If only she could ask Vijay these questions. Once, while furtively looking for him in the meditation hall, Manil, the attendant who cruised up and down the aisles, poked her with his bamboo rod and commented, "Look inward, no else." And when she did spot Vijay in the back of the men's section, he seemed entranced, sitting erect in the lotus position, motionless as a Buddha. He must have noticed her in the meditation hall. Of the 300, she was the only one sitting Western style in a chair. Though mortified by the chair, she'd had such a backache from days of sitting that she had no choice but to request one from Manil, Goenka's assistant. Manil, a tall and slender Indian, who worked hard at appearing tranquil, was not pleased with her request. Without removing his gaze from the horizon, he responded, "You're back? What did you do in past lives to bring this about?" What a disappointment. Manil's answer belied Goenka's vehement claims that his method lay outside the province of any specific religious tradition. Gradually, she was coming to appreciate the yawning chasm between the non-theistic stance of rarefied Buddhism and the superstitious beliefs of the masses. Even teaching assistants could not overcome their lust for magic, mystery, and authority. Once she saw Vijay at the 11 a.m. lunch and maneuvered herself into a seat next to him, she heard him take a deep breath, as though inhaling her aroma. But he neither looked at her nor spoke. In fact, no one spoke to anyone. The rule of noble silence reigned supreme. On the third morning, a bizarre episode enlivened the proceedings. During the meditation, someone farted loudly, and a couple of students giggled. The giggle was contagious, and soon several students were caught up in a giggling jag. Goenka was not amused, and immediately, wife in tow, stalked out of the meditation hall. Soon one of the assistants solemnly informed the student body that their teacher had been dishonored and would refuse to continue the course until all offending students left the ashram. A few students picked up and left, But for the next few hours, meditation was disturbed by the faces of the exiled, appearing at windows and hooting like owls. No mention was ever made again of the incident, but Pam suspected that there had been a late-night purge. Since the next morning, there were far fewer sitting Buddhas. Words were permitted only during the noon hour, when students with specific questions could address the teacher's assistants. On the fourth day at noon, Pam posed her question about insomnia to Manil. "Not for you to be concerned about," he replied, gazing off into the distance. "The body takes whatever sleep it requires." "Well then," Pam tried again, "could you tell me why shrill police whistles are being blown outside my window all night long?" "Forget such questions. Concentrate only upon Anapanasati. Just observe your breath. When you have truly applied yourself, such trivial events will no longer be disturbances." Pam was so bored by the breath meditation that she wondered whether she could possibly last the 10 days. Other than the sitting, the only available activity was listening to Goenka's nightly tedious discourses. Goenka, garbed in gleaming white, like all the staff, strove for eloquence but often fell short because an underlying shrill authoritarianism shone through. His lectures consisted of long repetitive tracts extolling the many virtues of Vipassana, which, if practiced correctly, resulted in mental purification, a path to enlightenment, a life of calmness and balance, an eradication of psychosomatic diseases, an elimination of the three causes of all unhappiness, craving, aversion, and ignorance. Regular Vipassana practice was like regular gardening of the mind, during which one plucked out impure weeds of thought. Not only that, Goenka pointed out, Vipassana practice was portable and provided a competitive edge in life. While others whiled away the waiting time at bus stops, the practitioner could industriously yank out a few weeds of cognitive impurity. The handouts for the Vipassana course were heavy with rules which, on the surface, seemed understandable and reasonable. But there were so many of them. No stealing, no killing of any living creature, no lies, no sexual activity, no intoxicants, no sensual entertainment, no writing, note-taking or pens or pencils, or reading, no music or radios, no phones, no luxurious high bedding, no bodily decorations of any sort, no immodest clothing, no eating after midday, except for first-time students who were offered tea and fruit at 5 p.m. Finally, the students were forbidden to question the teacher's guidance and instructions. They had to agree to observe the discipline and to meditate exactly as told. Only with such an obedient attitude, Goenka said, could students gain enlightenment. Generally, Pam gave him the benefit of the doubt. He was, after all, a dedicated man who had devoted his life to offering Vipassana instruction. Of course he was culture-bound. Who wasn't? And hadn't India always groaned under the weight of religious ritual and rigid social stratification? Besides, Pam loved Goenka's gorgeous voice. Every night she was entranced by his deep, sonorous chanting in ancient Pali of sacred Buddhist tracts. She had been moved in similar fashion by early Christian devotional music, especially Byzantine liturgical chants, by the cantors singing in synagogues, and once in rural Turkey, was transfixed by the hypnotic melodies of the muezzin calling the populace to prayer 5 times a day. Though Pam was a dedicated student, it was difficult for her to simply observe her breathing for 15 straight minutes without drifting off into one of her reveries about John. But gradually change occurred. The earlier disparate scenarios had coalesced into a single scene, from some news source, either TV, radio, or newspaper. She learned that John's family had been killed in an airplane crash. Again and again she imagined the scene. She was sick of it, but it kept on playing. As her boredom and restlessness increased, she developed an intense interest in small household projects. When she first registered at the office, and learned to her surprise that there was no fee for the 10-day retreat, she noted small bags of detergent in the ashram shop. On the third day, she purchased a bag, and thereafter spent considerable time washing and rewashing her clothes, hanging them on the clothesline behind the dormitory, the first clothesline she had seen since childhood, and at hourly intervals, checking on the drying process. Which bras and which panties were the best dryers? How many hours of night drying were equal to an hour's day drying? Or shade drying versus sun drying? Or hand-wrung clothes versus non-wrung clothes? On the fourth day came the great event. Goenka began the teaching of Vipassana. The technique is simple and straightforward. Students are instructed to meditate on their scalp until a sensation occurs. An itch, a tingle, a burning, perhaps the feeling of a tiny breeze upon the skin of the scalp. Once the sensation is identified, the student is simply to observe, nothing more. Focus on the itch. What is it like? Where does it go? How long does it last? When it disappears, as it always does, the meditator is to move to the next segment of the body, the face, and survey for stimuli like a nostril tickle or an eyelid itch. After these stimuli grow, ebb, and disappear, the student proceeds to the neck, the shoulders, until every part of the body is observed right down to the soles of the feet, and then returning back to the scalp and repeating the process again and again. Goenka's evening discourses provided the rationale for the technique. The key concept is anitya, impermanence. If one fully appreciates the impermanence of each physical stimulus, it is but a short step to extrapolate the principle of anitya to all of life's events and unpleasantries. Everything will pass, and one will experience equanimity if one can maintain the observer stance and simply watch the passing show. After a couple of days of vipassana, Pam found the process less onerous, and she gained skill and speed at focusing on her bodily sensations. On the seventh day, to her amazement, the whole process slipped into automatic gear, and she began sweeping, just as Goenka had predicted. It was as if someone poured a jug of honey on her head, which slowly and deliciously spread down to the bottom of her feet. She could feel a stirring, almost sexual hum, like the buzz of bumblebees enveloping her as the honey flowed down. The hours zipped by. Soon she discarded her chair and melded with the 300 other acolytes sitting in the lotus position at the feet of Goenka. The next 2 days of sweeping were the same, and each passed quickly. On the ninth night, she lay awake. She slept as badly as before, but was less concerned about it now, after learning from one of the other assistants, having given up on Manil, a Burmese woman, that insomnia in the Vipassana workshop is extremely common. Apparently, the prolonged meditative states make sleep less necessary. The assistant also cleared up the mystery of the police whistles. In southern India, night watchmen routinely blow whistles as they circle the perimeter of the territory they guard. It is a preventative measure warning off thieves in the same way the little red light on auto dashboards warns car thieves of the presence of an activated auto alarm. Often the presence of repetitive thoughts is most apparent when they vanish. And it was with a start that Pam realized that she had not thought about John for 2 entire days. John had vanished. The entire endless loop of fantasy had been replaced by the honeyed buzz of sweeping. How odd to realize that she now carried around her own pleasure maker, which could be trained to secrete feel-good endorphins. Now she understood why people got hooked, why they would go on a lengthy retreat, sometimes months, sometimes years. Yet, Now that she had finally cleansed her mind, why was she not elated? On the contrary, a shadow fell upon her success. Something about her enjoyment of sweeping darkened her thoughts. While pondering that conundrum, she dropped off into a light twilight sleep and was aroused a short time later by a strange dream image. A star with little legs, top hat and cane, tap dancing across the stage of her mind. A dancing star. She knew exactly what that dream image meant. Of all the literary aphorisms that she and John shared and loved, one of her favorites was Nietzsche's phrase from Zarathustra. One must have chaos in oneself to give birth to a dancing star. Of course. Now she understood the source of her ambivalence about Vipassana. Goenka was true to his word. He delivered exactly what he had promised. Equanimity, tranquility, or, as he often put it, equipoise. But at what price? If Shakespeare had taken up Vipassana, would Lear or Hamlet have been born? Would any of the masterpieces in Western culture have been written? One of Chapman's couplets drifted into mind. No pen can anything eternal write that is not steeped in the humor of the night. Steeped in the humor of the night. That was the task of the great writer. To immerse oneself in the humor of the night. To harness the power of darkness for artistic creation. How else could the sublime dark authors, Kafka, Dostoevsky, Virginia Woolf, Hardy, Camus, Plath, Poe, have illuminated the tragedy lurking in the human condition? Not by removing oneself from life, not by sitting back and observing the passing show. Even though Goenka proclaimed his teaching was non-denominational, his Buddhism shone through. In his nightly discourse come sales pitch, Goenka could not restrain himself from stressing that Vipassana was the Buddha's own method of meditation, which he, Goenka, was now reintroducing to the world. She had no objection to that. Though she knew little of Buddhism, she had read an elementary text on the plane to India and had been impressed by the power and truth of the Buddha's four noble truths. 1. Life is suffering. 2. Suffering is caused by attachments to objects, ideas, individuals, to survival itself. 3. There is an antidote to suffering, the cessation of desire, of attachment, of the self. 4. There is a specific pathway to a suffering-free existence, the 8-step path to enlightenment. Now she reconsidered. As she looked about her, at the entranced acolytes, the tranquilized assistants, the ascetics in their hillside caves content with a life dedicated to Vipassana sweeping, she wondered whether the four truths were so true after all. Had the Buddha gotten it right? Was the price of the remedy not worse than the disease? At dawn the following morning, she lapsed into even greater doubt. As she watched the small party of Jainist women walk to the bathhouse. The Jainists took the decree of no killing to absurd degrees. They hobbled down the path in a painfully slow, crab-like fashion, because they first had to gently sweep the gravel before them lest they step on an insect. Indeed, they could hardly breathe because of their gauze masks, which prevented the inhalation of any minuscule animal life. Everywhere she looked, there was renunciation, sacrifice, limitation, and resignation. Whatever happened to life, to joy, expansion, passion, carpe diem? Was life so anguished that it should be sacrificed for the sake of equanimity? Perhaps the four noble truths were culture-bound. Perhaps they were truths 2,500 years ago in a land with overwhelming poverty, overcrowding, starvation, disease, class oppression, and lack of any hope for a better future. But were they truths for her now? Didn't Marx have it right? Didn't all religions based on release or a better life hereafter target the poor, the suffering, the enslaved? But, Pam said to herself, after a few days of noble silence, she talked to herself a great deal. Wasn't she being an ingrate? Give credit where it was due. Hadn't Vipassana done its job? Calmed the mind and quashed her obsessive thoughts? Hadn't it succeeded where her own best efforts and Julius's and the group members' efforts had all failed? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Perhaps it was not a fair comparison. After all, Julius had put in a total of about 8 group sessions, 12 hours, while Vipassana demanded hundreds of hours. 10 full days plus the time and effort to travel halfway around the world. What might have happened if Julius and the group had worked on her that many hours? Pam's growing cynicism interfered with meditation. The sweeping stopped. Where had it gone? That delicious, mellifluous, buzzing contentment. Each new day her meditative practice regressed. The Vipassana meditation progressed no farther than her scalp. Those tiny itches, previously so fleeting, persisted and grew more robust. Itches evolved into pinpricks, then into a sustained burning that could not be meditated away. Even the early work in Anapanasati was undone. The dike of calmness built by breath meditation crumbled, and the surf of unruly thoughts of her husband, John, or revenge and airplane crashes came breaking through. Well, let them come. She saw Earl for what he was, an aging child, his large lips pursed and lunging for any nipple within range. And John. Poor, effete, pusillanimous John. Still unwilling to grasp there can be no yes without a no. And Vijay, too, who chose to sacrifice life, novelty, adventure, friendship upon the altar of the great god equanimity. Use the right word for the whole bunch, Pam thought. Cowards. Moral cowards. None of them deserved her. Flush them away. Now there was a powerful image. All the men, John, Earl, Vijay, standing in a giant toilet bowl, their hands raised imploringly, their squeals for help barely audible over the roar of the flushing water. That was an image worth meditating upon. 19. The flower replied, "You fool! Do you imagine I blossom in order to be seen? I blossom for my own sake because it pleases me, and not for the sake of others. My joy consists in my being and my blossoming." Bonnie opened the next meeting with an apology. "Sorry to one and all about my exit last week. I shouldn't have done that, but I don't know, it was out of my control."
"The devil made you do it," Tony smirked.
"Funny, funny, Tony. Okay, I know what you want. I chose to do it because I was pissed. That better?"
Tony smiled and gave her the thumbs-up signal. In the gentle voice he always used when addressing any of the women in the group, Gil said to Bonnie, "Last week after you left, Julia suggested you might have felt pissed at being ignored here. That basically the group replayed your description of what routinely happened to you in your childhood."
"Pretty accurate. Except I wasn't pissed. Hurt is a better term."
"I know pissed," said Rebecca. "And you were good and pissed at me."
Bonnie's face clouded over as she turned to Rebecca.
"Last week you said that Philip had clarified the reason you don't have girlfriends. But I don't buy that.
Envy of your good looks is not the reason you don't have girlfriends, or at least why you and I haven't become close. The real reason is that you're basically not interested in women. Or at least you're not interested in me. Whenever you say something to me in the group, it is always to bring the discussion back to you. I give you feedback about the way you handle, or mostly don't handle, anger. And then I get accused of being self-centered. Rebecca bristled. Do you or don't you want feedback? Isn't that what this group is about? What I want is for you to give me feedback about me. Or about me and someone else. It's always about you, Rebecca. Or you and me. And you're so attractive, it always swings things back to you and away from me. I can't compete with you. But it's not only your fault. The others play into this. And I need to ask all of you a question.
Bonnie swiveled her head, looking briefly at each member in turn as she said,
I never really get your interest. Why not?
The men in the room looked down. Bonnie didn't wait for an answer, but continued.
And another thing, Rebecca. What I'm saying to you about girlfriends is not news to you. I can remember clear as a bell you and Pam having an identical go-around about this.
Bonnie turned to Julius.
Speaking of Pam, I've been meaning to ask you, any news of her? When is she coming back? I miss her.
That was fast, Julius said. Bonnie, you are the master of the whirlwind segue. But for the moment, I'm going to let you get away with it and answer your question about Pam. Mainly because I was going to announce that she emailed me from Bombay. She's finished her meditation retreat and will be returning soon to the States. She should be here for the next meeting.
Turning to Philip, Julius said, You remember I mentioned Pam, our missing member, to you?
Philip replied with a brief nod.
And you, Philip, are the master of the fast nod, said Tony. It's amazing how much you stay in the middle of things without ever looking at anyone and without saying very much. Look at all this stuff going on around you. Bonnie and Rebecca squabbling over you. What are you feeling about all this? What are you feeling about the group?
When Philip did not immediately reply, Tony appeared uncomfortable. He looked around the group.
Shit, what is this? I feel like I'm breaking some kind of rule here, like farting in church. I'm just asking him the same kind of question everyone asked everyone else.
Philip broke the short silence.
Fair enough. I require time to collect my thoughts.
Here's what I was thinking. Bonnie and Rebecca have similar afflictions. Bonnie cannot tolerate being unpopular, whereas Rebecca cannot tolerate being no longer popular. Both are hostages to the caprice of what others think. In other words, happiness, for both of them, lies in the hands and heads of others. And for both, the solution is the same. The more one has in oneself, the less one will want from others.
In the silence that followed, one could almost hear sounds of cerebral mastication as the group attempted to digest Philip's words.
It doesn't appear that any of you are about to respond to Philip, said Julius. So I want to address an error I think I made a couple of minutes ago. Bonnie, I shouldn't have gone along with your segue to Pam. I don't want a repeat of last week when your needs were not dealt with. A few minutes ago, you were talking about why the group often overlooked you, and I thought you took a courageous step by asking everyone why you could not get their interest. But look what happened then. In the very next breath, you switched to Pam's return to the group, and, presto, in a couple of minutes, your question to us faded into history.
I noticed that too, said Stuart. So, Bonnie, it's like you arranged for us to ignore you. That's good feedback, Bonnie nodded her head. Very good. I probably do that a lot. I'll do some thinking about that.
Julius pressed on. I appreciate the thanks, Bonnie, but I can't help feeling you're doing the same thing now. Aren't you saying, in effect, that's enough focus on me? I should have a Bonnie bell here and ring it every time you switch away from yourself.
So what do I do? Bonnie asked.
Give us the reason you had no right to request feedback from us, Julia suggested.
I guess I just don't feel important enough.
But is it okay for others here to make this kind of request?
Oh, yes.
That means that others here are more important than you?
Bonnie nodded.
So, Bonnie, try this, Julius continued. Look around at each of the members here and answer this question. Who in the group is more important than you, and why? Julius could hear himself purring. He was coasting in familiar waters. For the first time in a while, certainly since Philip had entered the group, he knew exactly what he was doing. He had done what the good group therapist should do. He had translated one of his patient's central issues into the here and now, where it could be explored firsthand. It was always more productive to focus on the here and now than to work on the patient's reconstructions of an event from the past or from current outside life. Swiveling her head to glance briefly at each person in the group, Bonnie said,
Everyone here is more important than I am. A lot more important.
Her face was flushed, her breathing rapid. As much as she craved attention from others, it was obvious that she now wanted nothing more than invisibility. Be specific, Bonnie, Julius urged. Who is more important? Why? Bonnie looked around.
Everybody here. You, Julius. Look how you've helped everyone. Rebecca is drop-dead gorgeous, a successful lawyer, great kids. Gil is the CFO of a large hospital, as well as being a hunk. Stuart? Well, he's a busy doctor. Helps children. Helps parents. He has success written all over him. Tony?
Bonnie paused for a moment. Well, this'll be interesting. Tony, dressed as always in blue jeans, a black t-shirt and sneakers splattered with paint stains, leaned back in his chair.
First of all, Tony, you're you. No posturing, no games, just pure honesty. And you badmouth your profession, but I know you're no ordinary carpenter. You're probably an artist at your work. I see that BMW Roadster you scoot around in. And you're a hunk, too. I love you in a tight t-shirt. How's that for risk?
Bonnie looked around the group circle.
And who else? Philip. You've got intelligence to burn. You know everything. A teacher, you're going to be a therapist. Your words fascinate everyone. And Pam? Pam is awesome. A university professor, a free spirit. She compels attention. She's been everywhere, knows everyone, has read everything, stands up to anyone.
Reactions, anyone? To Bonnie's explanation of why she's less important than each of you? Julius's eyes circled the group. Her answer doesn't make sense to me, said Gil. Can you tell her? Said Julius. Sorry. What I mean is, and I don't want to offend, but Bonnie, your answer sounds regressive.
Regressive?
Bonnie screwed up her face in puzzlement. Well, what this group is about is that we're all just human beings trying to relate in a human way to one another, and that we check our roles, our degrees, our money, our BMW Roadsters at the door.
Amen, said Julius.
Amen,
chimed in Tony, who added, I'm with Gil. And just for the record, I bought that roadster used and it's put me in hock for the next 3 years.
And Bonnie, Gil continued, in your go-around, what you did was focus exactly on those external things. Professions, money, successful kids. None of those relate to why you are the least important person in this room. I consider you very important. You're a key member. You're engaged with all of us. You're warm, giving. You even offered me a place to sleep a couple weeks ago when I didn't want to go home. You keep the group focused. You work hard here.
Bonnie held her ground. I'm a drag. My whole life has been about shame for my alcoholic parents, always lying about my family. Inviting you home, Gil, was a big event for me. I never could invite kids home, full of fear that my father would show up drunk. What's more, my ex-husband was a drunk. My daughter's a heroin addict.
You're still evading the point, Bonnie, said Julius. You talk of your past, your daughter, your ex, your family. But you, where are you?
I am these things. A composite of all these things. What else can I be? I'm a boring, pudgy librarian. What I do is catalog books. I don't know what you mean. I'm confused. I don't know where or who I am.
Bonnie began to cry, pulled out a tissue, blew her nose loudly, closed her eyes, raised both hands and drew circles in the air and between the sobs muttered,
This is enough for me. It's all I can take today.
Julia shifted into another gear and addressed the entire group. Let's take a look at what's happened in the past several minutes. Who's got some feelings or observations? Having succeeded in moving the group into the here and now, he advanced to the next step. In his view, the work in therapy consisted of two phases. First, interaction, often emotional, and second, understanding that interaction. That's the way therapy should proceed. An alternating sequence of evocation of emotions and then understanding. So now he attempted to switch the group into the second phase by saying, Let's back up and take a dispassionate look at what's just transpired. Stuart was about to describe the sequence of events when Rebecca jumped in.
I think the important thing was Bonnie giving her reasons for feeling unimportant, and then assuming we would all agree. That's when she became confused and cried, and said she had had enough. I've seen her do that before.
Tony said, Yeah, I agree. Bonnie, you do get emotional when you get a lot of attention. Are you embarrassed by the spotlight?
Still sobbing, Bonnie said, I should have been appreciative, but look at what a mess I made of it. And look how much better others would have used this time.
The other day, said Julius, I had a conversation with a colleague about one of his patients. He said she had a habit of catching spears thrown at her and then stabbing herself with them. Maybe I'm being a little loose here, Bonnie, but that popped in mind when I saw how you take things and punish yourself with them.
I know you're all feeling impatient with me. I guess I still don't know how to use the group.
Well, you know what I'm going to say, Bonnie. Exactly who here was impatient? Look around the room. The group could absolutely count on Julius asking this question. He had never been known to let such a statement go by without honing in on it and asking for names.
Well, I think Rebecca wanted me to stop.
What? Why, I... Hold up a minute, Rebecca. Julius was being unusually directive today. Bonnie, what exactly did you see? What cues did you pick up?
About Rebecca? Well, she was silent. Didn't speak a word. I can't win. I was doing my best to be quiet so you couldn't accuse me of taking attention from you. Can't you recognize a gift?
Bonnie was about to respond when Julius asked her to continue with her descriptions of who was bored.
Well, nothing I can spell out concretely. But you can just tell when people are bored. I bore myself.
Philip wasn't looking at me, but then he never looks at anyone. I know the group was waiting to hear from Philip. What he said about popularity was far more interesting to the group than my whining.
Well, I wasn't bored with you, replied Tony. And I didn't see anyone else bored either. And what Philip had to say was not more interesting. He stays so much in his head that I don't get real excited by his comments. I don't even remember them.
I do, said Stuart. Tony, after you commented about how he was always in the center of things despite saying so little, he said that Bonnie and Rebecca had a very similar problem. They're overinvested in the opinions of others. Rebecca gets too inflated and Bonnie too deflated. It was something like that.
You'd be in a clicker again, said Tony, pantomiming holding a camera and taking pictures.
Right. Keep me honest. I know, I know. Less observations, more feelings.
Well, I agree that Philip is somehow central without having to say much. And it does feel like breaking the rules to confront Philip about anything.
That's an observation and an opinion, Stuart, said Julius. Can you go on to the feelings?
Well, I guess I have some envy about Rebecca's interest in Philip. I felt it was odd that no one asked Philip how he felt about that.
Well, that's not quite a feeling, is it?
Closer, said Julius. First cousin to a feeling. Keep going.
I feel threatened by Philip. He's too smart. Also, I feel ignored by him. I don't like being ignored.
Bingo, Stuart. Now you're honing in, said Julius.
Any questions for Philip?
Julius labored to keep his tone soft and delicate. His job was to help the group include, not to threaten and exclude Philip, by insisting he perform in a manner not yet possible. It was for that reason he called upon Stuart, rather than the more confrontative Tony.
Sure, but it's hard to ask Philip questions.
He's right here, Stuart. Another fundamental Julius rule. Never allow members to speak of one another in the third person.
Well, that's the issue. It's hard to talk to him.
Stuart turned to Philip.
I mean, Philip, it's hard to talk to you because you never look at me, like right now. Why is that?
I prefer to keep my own counsel, said Philip, still gazing toward the ceiling. Julius was poised to leap into the discussion if needed, but Stuart stayed patient.
I don't follow.
If you ask something of me, I want to search within myself, free of any distractions, in order to give you my best possible answer.
But you're not looking at me makes me feel we're not in contact.
But my words must tell you otherwise.
How about walking and chewing gum? Interjected Tony.
Pardon? Philip, puzzled, turned his head but not his eyes toward Tony.
Like how about doing both at the same time? Looking at him and giving a good answer?
I prefer to search my own mind. Meeting the gaze of the other distracts me from searching for the answer the other might wish to hear. Silence prevailed while Tony and the others mulled Philip's response. Stuart then posed another question.
Well, let me ask you, Philip. All that discussion about Rebecca's preening for you, how did that make you feel?
You know,
Rebecca's eyes showed fire.
I am really beginning to resent this, Stuart. It's as though Bonnie's fantasy has now passed into the books as gospel.
Stuart refused to be diverted.
Okay, delete that question, Philip. I'll ask you this.
How did you feel about all of the discussion about you the last meeting?
The discussion was of great interest. And I am unflaggingly attentive.
Philip looked at Stuart and continued.
But I have no emotional responses, if that's your inquiry.
None? That doesn't seem possible, replied Stuart.
Before beginning the group, I read Julius's book on group therapy, and was well prepared for the events of these meetings. I expected certain things to happen, that I would be an object of curiosity, that some would welcome me and some not, that the established hierarchy of power would be unsettled by my entrance, that the women might look favorably upon me and the men unfavorably, that the more central members might resent my appearance, while the less influential ones might be protective of me. Anticipating these things has resulted in my viewing the events in the group dispassionately.
Stuart, as Tony before him, was stunned by Philip's response, and lapsed into silence as he digested Philip's words. Julius said,
I have a bit of a dilemma.
He waited a moment. On the one hand, he continued, I feel it's important to follow up this discussion with Philip. But I'm also concerned about Rebecca.
Where are you, Rebecca? You look distressed, and I know you've been trying to get in.
I'm feeling a little bruised today and shut out, ignored, by Bonnie, by Stuart.
Keep going.
There's a lot of negative stuff coming my way, about being self-centered, not being interested in women friends, about posturing for Philip. It stings, and I resent it.
I know what that's like, said Julius. I have those same knee-jerk reactions to criticism. But let me tell you what I've learned to do. The real trick is to think of feedback as a gift. But first you must decide whether it's accurate. The way I proceed is to check in with myself and ask whether it clicks with my own experience of myself. Does any part, even a tad of it, even 5%, ring true? I try to recall if people in the past have given me this feedback before. I think about other people with whom I can check it out.
I wonder if someone is honing in on one of my blind spots.
Something they see that I do not. Can you try this?
That's not easy, Julius. I feel tight about it.
Rebecca clasped her hand to her sternum.
Right here.
Give that tightness a voice. What's it saying?
It's saying, how will I look? It's shame. It's being found out. This business about people noticing my playing with my hair makes me cringe. Makes me want to say, it's none of your fucking business. It's my hair. I'll do what I want with it.
In his most teacherly voice, Julius responded. Years ago, there was a therapist named Fritz Perls, who started a school called Gestalt Therapy. You don't hear much about him nowadays, but anyway, he did a lot of focusing on the body. You know, look what your left hand is doing right now, or I see you stroking your beard a lot. He'd ask patients to exaggerate the movement. Keep making a tighter fist with your left hand, or keep stroking that beard more and more vigorously, and stay aware of what gets evoked. I always felt there was a lot to Pearl's approach because so much of our unconscious is expressed through body movements that lie out of our own awareness. But I've never made much use of it in therapy. The reason? Exactly because of what's happening now, Rebecca. We often get defensive when others spot us doing things of which we are unaware. So I understand how uncomfortable you feel, but even so, can you stay with it
and try to learn if there's something of value in the feedback?
In other words, you're saying, be mature.